For the week of April 16th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 362, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
In New York, I'm Michael Geltz. I thought you were on Pandora.
Why do you say that?
Because your home is filled with water.
Oh, yes, that's true. I came home to a flood. Yes.
So you were away last week. You were here in New York. We hung out one day. It was magical. We were in person. We didn't know what to do. We kind of turned our backs to each other so we could keep talking. It would be more comfortable.
Yeah, I'm not used to talking to you and seeing you at the same time. It's just very awkward.
It's like virtual reality.
Yes.
Except it's like you felt like you were actually there with me.
Yeah, it was almost like I had 3D glasses on.
Yeah. And then you got a call from your maid or house cleaner?
Yeah, from our house cleaner say, hey, you know, bad news, your house is flooded.
Wow. And you've just gotten home. And how bad is it? Is the sink overflowed upstairs? What was it, like a little water damage or what's going on?
Well, you know, if it were downstairs, it would be just the downstairs that's the problem. But since it was upstairs, you know, it's pretty much Noah's Ark, but in reverse.
And there's a bonus, too. So because you got people in there looking at the water damage, figuring out what to do, they also got to inform you, guess what?
You've got asbestos.
Huzzah. So it's a good week at the Sperling. Maybe this is the week you'll add the PayPal donate button to the Showbiz Sandbox website.
If there was ever a week we needed a PayPal or donate button, it was this week.
Yeah, I've been back to the Apple store multiple times. You've got Pandora in your home taking place right now. Maybe Cameron will come over and shoot some footage.
You mean James Cameron, of course.
I do. So people feel bad for you. I feel bad for Les Moonves.
So do I. I mean, I read this article too, and I know exactly where you're headed with this.
Let's start a Kickstarter campaign. They are paying him last year, his total package, including, you know, stock, whatever, $69.6 million. It's like they're trying to insult him.
I mean, look, he runs one of the most successful, if not the most successful television network, around. I think he's worth at least 69.7 or 70 million.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get him to 70 million. It's like he's a discount can of peas, you know, $5.99. Like, no, it's $6. Oh, well. So he needs a little comforting. So maybe he'll listen to the show. And if he is, what will he hear us talking about?
He'll hear us talking about us asking him for a loan.
What else?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll talk about the Cannes Film Festival. The official lineup was announced. Netflix is growing as a player on the Quasette. And some are insisting that any Netflix films that are shown at Cannes must get a theatrical release in France. Mon Dieu! In music, we'll be joined by our show's longtime friend and musical expert, Sal Nunziato. We'll talk about the upcoming Record Store Day on April 22nd, what it's like to sell albums on Facebook, and his band, the John Sally Ride. They have a new album set for release titled A New Set of Downs.
Actually, it's out now.
Oh, it is. Is it about football? It sounds like it should be about football.
It's not about football.
Okay. During our book filter segment, Michael will talk about the biography of the last giant of late night. No points for guessing who that might be, by the way. On Inside Baseball, we'll talk about the looming writer's strike, how things stand, and what comes next. That's followed by a brief look at Bloomberg's in-depth article on ESPN. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world, which is what everybody is talking about these days. They don't do it as in-depth as we do, but they do talk about it for a very good reason. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. That's where we start our charts. Then we pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, anywhere we can find information. Our fans, people writing in and sharing box office information for us. And everybody agrees the number one film around the world is, of course, Fate of the Furious. This is the Fast and the Furious number 8. And it made $532 million on its opening weekend. Thank you, China. Thank you, 64 territories, in fact. $100 million in North America alone. A ton of money in China. The biggest opening weekend of all time, just beating out Star Wars, The Force Awakens. In fact, Fate of the Furious made more money probably than every other film on the chart combined.
That's true. How many screens did it open on? Do we have that figure?
I don't have worldwide screen figures, no.
Ah, okay, I do actually. I just found it. The Fate of the Furious played in nearly 23,000 theaters around the world. Now, again, that's theaters, not screens. At least I believe so.
Right. And of course, this is a record that will fall quickly.
Yes.
Not because it's not remarkably, successful, but because more and more films get in release day and date around the world, especially when you're in the top two markets. That's when you're going to rake in a lot of dough. But one movie made more money than every other movie in the world combined, perhaps. Because when you look at the chart of the top 25 around the world that we have info on, you're looking at about $150, $160 million total for all the movies below Fate of the Furious. And that gets you down to number 25, which is an art film called Their Finest, a British movie that made $780,000. So we're grabbing pretty much all the information that's out there. I mean, this movie made perhaps triple what all the rest of the movies combined made. Now, there's lots of movies and lots of territories that aren't on this chart. So, but if you add them all up, there is a good chance that this one film made more money than all the rest in the entire world on this weekend.
Well, and it is the eighth film in the franchise, the Fast and Furious franchise, and some hay was made about the fact that, well, it opened in North America to $100.2 million, which is below, you know, what Fast and Furious 7 and Fast and Furious 6 made. But
well, here, substantially below. I mean, it made $140 or $150 million on opening weekend last time, which, of course, opening weekend is 4 days now. It's not three. But, that's 40% lower or 35% or something like that. So that's a substantial drop. But, yeah, this is a worldwide game you're playing. And people wrote an article, I think it was a Hollywood Reporter, saying, hey, it's time to, you know, put this franchise to bed. I'm like, really? I don't think that's happening.
Well, here's the thing. A couple points. You're right, Michael. It was 32% below Fast and Furious 7 here in North America. Again, I'm only talking about North America, and here's why. You know, they're saying, well, gee, as you just mentioned, Michael, put it to bed. It's kind of stick a fork in it. It's done. But overseas, it's doing well. Now, let's just go back to North America for a second to Fast and Furious 6, which opened to $102.7 million in 2013. And if you recall, the Fast and Furious 7 kind of had this, curiosity factor of Paul Walker having died, obviously in a tragic car
accident. During the making of the film, yeah.
Yeah, tragic car accident offset. And so there was a lot of curiosity there. So, of course, the opening weekend was higher. But if you look at Fast and Furious 6, that opened to $102.7 million. This opened to $100.2 million. So not that far off over a holiday weekend.
Yeah. So it's a big, big opening. It also cost a big, big ticket to make. $250 million is the estimated budget. I'm going to guess that Vin Diesel and some others have a little piece of that as well, that whatever their salary is, it's going to get bumped up once they hit certain markers or however their contract is structured. So it's a very expensive film, but, you know, it's doubled its budget on opening weekend worldwide. It's clearly going to get to $1 billion unless something bizarre happens. So, you know, it's going to be profitable. It made the most money in a single day in China. In terms of local currency, it was a record for a single day in China. It made a record amount, I think, in previews in China on Thursday. It's benefiting in part because China is still churning out lots of movie theaters. They are still on a heavy rate of construction. That's according to a Hollywood Reporter. It's going to have a ways to go before it beats The Mermaid. That's the all-time record in China, which has made $527 million in its opening weekend. We'll have to see how long China lets this movie play. But they want their box office to be on top. They want the world to be talking about their box office, and that means giving more room to more Hollywood movies and movies from other countries. And it paid off here. Now Chris Dodd of the MPAA makes the obvious point that China, which in a few years will become the number one market, the fate of U.S. studios and China's box office are inextricably linked.
Well, and a couple things here. You know, whether the film comes from the U.S. and Hollywood or France or London, you know, in the United Kingdom or China itself, any film doing well in Chinese theaters is good, period. Doesn't matter where the film comes from. I know it does matter to the Chinese government, but the reality is for the exhibition market in China, films need to do well. People need to be going to the movie theater and paying to see movies. As long as they're doing that, then everything
will be all right.
Yeah.
And now keep in mind, however, that the studio is probably only getting about 25% of that box office gross back into North America.
That is correct.
Or wherever they keep that money. So You can make $200 million in China, you're only taking home $50 million. You make $200 million in North America, you're taking home $100 million. So that market is still low in terms of global box office and how much the studios can take back. Maybe the global trend is more towards 40%, more like that.
They're trying to push it to 40%, absolutely, yes.
Okay. And, you know, you want people to go to the movies, and that was one of the details that sort of got slipped by me, at least, when we had the CinemaCon and all that going on. I didn't quite catch this or make enough of it, I don't think. But according to the MPAA, after three consecutive years of declines, we're talking about North America, after 3 years of dropping, the number of frequent moviegoers last year, aged 18 to 24, increased 26% from 5.7 million to 7.2 million. And a frequent moviegoer is someone who goes to a movie like once a month. Every few weeks they're going to movies, or certainly they see three or four or five in quick succession in summer. So come the end of the year, they've been to the movies a good dozen times. So that's pretty good news.
Yeah, and I can't remember, I'd have to go back and look at the report, but there were specific reasons why it declined and specific reasons why it went back up. And these are usually movie related. So a movie was released, or a couple of movies were released, that had that particular demographic go a little bit more.
But we're talking 12 movies. So this is not one particular movie. This is a person who goes to the movies a lot. I thought that's the point of a frequent moviegoer, that you're looking at people not getting a distortion because, you know, Avatar opened, because they may go to one movie, but that doesn't change anything. They went to the movie theaters 12 times. And those frequent moviegoers, those people 18 to 24, probably will not be seeing a movie that debuted in Cannes.
Well, they might once those movies in Cannes that debut and premiere this year at this year's festival make their way around the world, as they often do.
Well, they do, but this year I'm saying that there are not a lot of big Hollywood movies, certainly not in competition. It was sort of a notable pullback from Cannes, but they did announce their official lineup, and that meant we learned about a lot of different programming going on at Cannes. It looks like a pretty political year. A lot of classic Cannes directors are back with new movies. Nicole Kidman has four projects, and since I'm not going, it just makes me depressed to read about it.
Well, okay. Well, a couple things. One, we're talking about worldwide box office, right? I mean, we didn't even go down the whole list of
oh my God, I totally forgot
films.
About that.
I mean, yeah, well, do we know, even need to do that? Or, I mean,
oh my God, Fast and Furious made a lot of money. Sure. You know, The Boss Baby made $50 million over the weekend. It's at $280 million worldwide. Beauty and the Beast made another $35 million. And while we were away, as we all knew, it passed the $1 billion mark. Huge success story for that film. Smurfs, The Lost Village, is losing a little steam, but it made $22 million over the weekend. It's at just under $100 million. But pretty wisely, this movie costs less than the last two. So usually sequels in this era cost more, but Smurfs is costing less because they see a declining audience.
Well, it's a tiny movie. Get it?
And number five is a bit of a confusing one. It looks like it's A Chinese Odyssey Part 2, Cinderella. Which I think is a reissue of a 1995 film. But I'm confused. I tried to figure out what was going on, but part three came out many years later, just last, you know, holiday season. That was in 2016, some 20 years after parts one and two premiered back in the mid-90s. So as far as I can tell, this is a reissue of part two. It's grossed $16 million so far. Looks like it's open just in China. Am I right? Am I wrong? Was there increased interest in this movie because of part three? Did they actually release a 22-year-old movie and make $16 million in one weekend in China? Let us know. You know, reach out to us if you have any info on this, because I couldn't figure it out online. Sperling, how would they reach us?
Well, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or search for us on Facebook. Our Facebook page can be found under Showbiz Sandbox. You can like us there.
Ghost in the Shell is at number six, the Scarlett Johansson adaptation of the classic manga. $10 million over the weekend, $152 million worldwide. Right below that is Going in Style, which is the older men in cahoots having hijinks. $10 million on the weekend. That stars Morgan Freeman, I think. $35 million total. Right below that is Kong, Skull Island, which has passed $550 million worldwide and is a solid success story for a franchise that needed lifting. It's the most successful Kong film since the original. And number nine is Power Rangers, which has made $130 million worldwide. And then The Shack, which is a faith-based movie and perhaps got a little boost from Easter weekend. That made $4.8 million on the weekend. It's at just under $70 million. And if we skip down, we can see there are some movies in North America like The Case for Christ, which also opened up on Easter weekend. It only cost $3 million to make, and it's made $8.4 million total. So you can see how those things work out. It's a successful, focused, targeted movie for an audience that wants them and will turn out in numbers that can make it profitable for you.
Well, now back to Cannes for just a second, because
That's good with the box office. And the last thing I would say of note is in Russia, a film called Spacewalker opened up, and it's about the space race from the Russian point of view, about young cosmonauts trying to get into the program. Sounds kind of interesting and cool for the director. It looks like a segue from TV and some successful comedies to a more serious film. I'm kind of interested in checking it out.
Well, that's the box office around the world. And, you know, we were talking about Cannes a second ago. And the reality is, much like we're talking about box office from around the world, which includes films from around the world. You mentioned, hey, you know, this year's Cannes lineup doesn't have a lot of big Hollywood studio movies in it, which is fine because, as we just mentioned, guess what? Movie making and filmmaking is actually done all over the world, always has been. But now movies get to travel a lot more.
And bringing it into Cannes, sometimes they don't travel enough, however, because French exhibitors reacted a bit strongly to the fact that two films backed by Netflix have been selected in the upcoming lineup. And they're saying, okay, that's great, that's wonderful, that's good, but these movies need to be seen in the theater. You know, and they're like, we understand Cannes is independent from us. We understand that Netflix is doing a good thing by funding movies, but we want them in theaters. And it turns out, apparently, Netflix is already planning to launch an agreement to release these movies theatrically in France. I'm not quite sure why that would be as such, but it does have the strictest regulations in France in terms of when movies can be shown and streamed and all that sort of stuff. So they're trying to make good and keep the French market happy. And keep Cannes happy, and presumably everybody will come to an agreement.
Well, but I wonder, you know, here in the United States, Netflix, that is, distributes movies theatrically that they show and stream online. They do it day and date. And of course, no movie theaters or very few movie theaters actually show them. Because heck, why show a movie that people can see at home for, you know, the price of their subscription? So I wonder if in France, Netflix will do something they haven't been willing to do in other markets, which is release the film in theaters first and then have a delayed home streaming release. I doubt it.
Well, we'll have to find out, but that's certainly one big thing that people are going to be paying attention to at Cannes. This weekend, however, people in North America will be paying attention to Record Store Day. I actually don't know if that's a worldwide event, but this Saturday, April 22nd, coming up, is Record Store Day, a day to shine a spotlight on your local record store if you still have one. And here to talk about it is our friend Sal Nunziato.
Well, you know, I always wondered what Record Store Day was, so I had to do a little research, and it's an annual event, Michael, and you know this, but it's an annual event to celebrate record stores, and it once included unique 7-inch singles, almost as a novelty item for hardcore collectors. Now that vinyl may soon become the biggest profit center for physical product, all those Record Store Day special releases are actually kind of big bucks. Here to talk about, as you mentioned, Michael, the state of the music industry is our frequent guest, Sal Nunziato. So I'm reintroducing Sal. When it comes to music, Sal has done it all. Sal, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you guys. Thanks.
That's right. Sal was the co-owner of the late lamented New York City record store NYCD. He purchased vinyl collections and then sells them at record shows and online via Facebook and other sites. If you got a lot of albums you need to part with, you better call Sal. He has a popular blog called Burnwood Tonight, on which he and passionate fans discuss their love for music of all varieties. He's also a drummer, been in multiple bands over the years, loves New Orleans jazz and soul, and he's in a band called the John Sally Ride, and their new album is out now. It's just hit stores, and just in time for Record Store Day, actually, and he's here to talk about the album and so much more. The album is called A New Set of Downs, which made Sperling ask,
is it about football?
No, it's not. We John Dunbar, who's the singer-songwriter, we realized every song on the record was a lyrical downer. And you know, it's a lot of, you know, love gone wrong, and this one's leaving me, and that one's leaving me, and you know, it just, the title just came to John, and we loved it, and so we ran with it. I should point out, the record is out digitally now. You can get it on all your digital sites: Spotify, Amazon, iTunes, Bandcamp. In the interim, we thought we were going to have the record out for physical sale by the end of April. As it turns out, Cool Cat Records wants to put it out, and so
awesome.
Yeah, so we're happy. They're an incredible indie label specializing in power pop. They have records, reissues out by Brinsley Schwartz and Cotton Mather. And so we're going to be waiting on the physical product for a little bit longer, but it's out there now for you to grab digitally, and I hope you do.
And a little later on in the show, we're actually going to be talking about how, and maybe I shouldn't, you know, spoil this, but we're going to be talking about how, you know, record companies prefer to have the album not stream on Spotify and in all those digital outlets before the physical product is available. You're doing the exact opposite.
Not by choice, but yes.
So will they be doing it on vinyl as well?
They'll be doing the CD, and we'll be doing the vinyl ourselves. So CD copies will be coming out, and we'll try to time it the same way once we get an exact date on the release.
Now, there's a lot of, you know, backlog in vinyl. It's very complicated. There's not a ton of capacity. And there's a lot of people now looking to make use of that limited capacity. Jack White had to open up his own vinyl factory. Did you have trouble scheduling, or how was that process?
We're not making thousands and thousands of copies of this thing. You know, it's going to be small. And it was really just a matter of timing. It was a matter of, let's do it now. And then this opportunity came up where somebody wanted to do it for us. And so all of the details and responsibility, for the most part, fell into someone else's hands. So, you know, we just have to sit and wait at this point and have that all pieced together once we all agree on everything. But you know, we're all happy with that label. So, you know, it should be a good thing. It's exciting nonetheless, you know.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. And let me ask you this. John Sally Ride. Sally Ride, to me, is somebody who, you know, first woman in space, right?
Yes. John Sally was also a NBA basketball player.
And so you combine the two names. And
there are two Sals in the band, and John. So we were just playing around with our names. Sal Mehta on bass, Sal Nunziato on drums, John Dunbar on guitar, John, Sal. We're both Italian, both got called Sally in our lifetimes. And
you're taking us on a ride.
Our senses of humor came together, and, you know, the John Sally Ride sounds very psychedelic, very, very 60s. And we just thought it was funny, you know? And there are many people who don't find it funny because they're mistaking Sally Ride for Christa McAuliffe. Oh. They thought it was in bad taste. And I said, no, Sally Ride is alive.
Actually, she's no longer alive.
Oh, she's not?
No, she passed away due to cancer, actually. Recently.
Recently. Well, it's, you know, the name is still funny.
2012 is when she passed away.
Let me tell you, one of the worst things to happen in when you're in the entertainment world is, like, your friend says, I got a book, come to my play, come to my reading, here's my album, here's my theater piece. Oh, you know, you're like, oh God, I hope I can have something good to say. It's always, you're never like, yeah, it's great. You're like, oh shit. I swear to God. You're like, so I have lots of friends. They publish books, they have projects, they have, you know, art exhibits. It happens all the time. I have a firm rule that I just don't review friends' stuff. You know, like, I'm not going to review your book. I will help promote it in whatever way I can. But I just, you know, I just don't want to be reviewing friend stuff. And I'll say, hey, here's my friend. They got a book. So, you know, Sal says, I got an album. I'm like, great. I've seen him live. He's cool. He's good. I'm like, ah, shoot. I hope I have something. And you know what? It's good. Thank God. I'm just relieved that it's good. It's a really good album. I can enthusiastically talk about it. It's just a relief for me personally, Sal.
I appreciate. Thank you for that, because I know the feeling very well, you know, where people, many musician friends, same thing. You know, read my screenplay, read, you know, whatever it may be. And you just, you want to be polite and you want to support the people. And sometimes you can't hide that frozen smile on your face when you have to, you know, report back. But it feels good that people are receiving this really well. And we're very proud of it.
Well, as a former record store owner, NYCD was, you know, your record store. I would imagine a lot of your friends and bands would come in and say, hey, here's my new record. Here's like 20 copies. Can you sell them? And when you listened to it, thought, no, not even, no, I can't. I can't sell these.
There was no real rule for us. I mean, if we really genuinely liked the person, we wouldn't say, no, we're not going to carry your CD. But it became difficult, because as ridiculous as this may sound, we would run out of space.
Right.
We had a limited amount of display space. And so if we happen to have a lot of new releases coming in or big batches of used product coming in, that very prime space on the wall that was being held by Joe Schmo would have to come down, and the new, you know, Beyonce or whoever would have to go on display. So it, you know, it wasn't always the easiest thing, you know, and honestly, it's, you know, it was hard enough to sell the Rolling Stones.
Beyonce.
well, who knew that Joe Schmo would be headlining Bonnaroo this year?
What's that?
But just making a joke.
I was making a joke, and that's exactly the response my jokes usually get.
And would you be like, they'd say, well, you can just take them on commission. And you're like, it's not even that they were asking to fork out for 5 or 10 CDs. They just wanted them in the store. That's got to be rough.
Never worked out. Because somebody would say, here are 10 copies. You keep X amount of each copy. And then they'd show up 2.5 years later and say, did you sell any? And we'd only count 8 in inventory, because maybe, you know, 2 were swiped, you know, it was impossible. It was an impossible task. So we basically just said, here's your $15. Here you go. Get out. You know,
Well, Cool Cat will have a better time with you. It's hard for me to imagine that you didn't write some of these lyrics, because this album is kind of power pop, rock and roll. It feels just very much like your sensibility from John Dunbar, the lyricist. There's lines like, your closest friends are the ones you never got around to telling, take a hike.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's funny, because I thought I heard you say a couple of questions ago, how did this project come about?
Yeah.
And it came about because, you know, John Dunbar was a friend for a long time, and I always loved his songwriting, and we just never really talked about it. He never approached me, I never approached him, and it was that very song, Your Closest Friends, that struck a chord with me. And I told him, I said, this is me in a nutshell. This is, you're nailing this, you know? And little by little, these songs would pop out, and I would say, wow, that's me. And that song too. And boy, I could have written that song. And it really just unfolded that way, where the three of us got together in a studio to rehearse for a gig. It was a one-shot gig. And it was as if we had been playing together our whole lives. You know, it was not long after David Bowie had passed, and we were rehearsing the songs to play live, and I think the bass player said, should we do a Bowie song at the gig? You know, and I said, if you want. And John said, how about this? And he played the opening chord to Ziggy Stardust. And 3.5 minutes later, the song was finished, as if it was in our DNA. Huh. And so, you know, it just gelled. It was as wonderful as a project, you know, and I can't say enough about it. It was really just a great, great time.
Closest friends, to put you down is a right that they feel they have earned.
Well, I didn't write that, but hear, hear.
Well, you know, I just came back from New York City, where I walked past on a regular basis on West 4th Street, Discorama, which, of course, is now really just an empty store.
Right.
I was really, I thought for sure, well, you know, maybe this one store will still be open. No, it's not.
So does Record Store Day create conflicted feelings for you now that your record store is online, in a sense, on Facebook and other outlets, or at record shows person to person? Or is it still something that you can wholly get excited by and embrace?
I didn't like Record Store Day from the word go. I'm excited about certain records that will be released for Record Store Day because I love records and I love music. But the whole process, the original mission statement, what's wrong with it, everything about it is a very, very soured point. I just don't like any of it. I think it's I think the whole point from the beginning was to create interest again in vinyl and to bring people back to the mom and pop store. I believe that was the
and
mission
that's
state. And I don't see how releasing limited versions of oddball side-by-side cover versions on splatter-colored vinyl is the way to do it. Now, anybody who is frequenting a record store on a regular basis still does that with whatever stores are left. The old timers did not need something special with odd packaging to go to a record store. We would go to record stores. If I had a record store in walking distance from my house, I would put a locker and a cot in the back room and live there because that's how much I love record stores. Seeing these pieces that are coming out every year, just there's no reason for me to want to go back to this record store. So there's that aspect of it.
Is it sort of like the comic book world where you cater to the hardcore fans with, you know, seven different covers of a new release so that they'll collect it rather than building a new audience and reaching out to people who don't come to record stores all the time? Is that sort of the problem?
That's one of the problems. The other problem is that there's absolutely zero policing of the internet, and there should be. And I'll tell you why there should be. Because if I took a rare Led Zeppelin bootleg and tried getting $1,000 for it on eBay, I would have my eBay account suspended. Because it's happened. I know it. I've posted something, they took it down, and I got a warning. And yet, if you go on eBay right now, Not every, that's an exaggeration. Many of this coming Record Store Day releases are not only being offered, they're offered for 25 times the amount of the list price. And it's not that difficult to police. Why? Because I found it. I looked it up. I looked up a certain record that I wanted, and it was there. Five different copies of it. Why are these people allowed to do this?
So what you're saying is it's almost like concert tickets where the on sale has yet to happen, but somehow the secondary market is flooded with tickets already.
And that's right. And the owners of the record stores they sign a waiver that says they cannot do this. They're also supposed to sell the records for the list prices, maybe just like the tickets, for a few dollars more. But the Bruce Springsteen Hammersmith 75 LP, which is a 4-LP set, and if I have my numbers correct, I could tell you, it's a run of 3,000. I believe the list price on that is $59.99, and there are copies currently being sold, even though they're not available yet, being sold for between $150 and $200.
And the people dropping the ball there are the record labels.
Well, they're the people who are behind Record Store Day as well. I mean, they could very simply, if they took a couple of interns and an hour, type in 50 titles, see them all on eBay, and find out who these people are and suspend their accounts. So there's that aspect of it that I don't like, because there's this furor, like, oh my God, I have to have this release. I want this release. And the music lover in me has this, you know, unnecessary panic, you know, because I want to get it. And my feeling is, if you just put out Bruce Springsteen Live at the Hammersmith as a 4-LP set and kept it as an affordable price, which you can do, there's a really good chance you'll sell 3,000 of them.
Well, now you can get this album, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, Hammersmith, Odeon London, 75, for $12 on Amazon, but it is a CD.
So that's right. This is, well, the record store day is about vinyl. You know, that's what it's about. So for the vinyl fetishists and for the people who, you know, suddenly, you know, brought the phrase, but it sounds warmer into their vocabulary. You know, you want the record. I mean, and I admit to that. I've fallen, you know, into this hole, this rabbit hole of, you know, vinyl is back, and I love it, you know.
And
but it just seems to me that a lot of this is a missed opportunity. For example, they're releasing The Cure's Greatest Hits. It's never been available on vinyl before. The only compilation available that covers the entire career of The Cure was something called Galore.
We're not talking Standing at the Sea or whatever?
Well, that was the early singles. But then Galore covered, you know, the early and later singles. That fetches about $150 now, $200, because it has never been released. So now it's record store day, and they make the announcement. Cure Greatest Hits and The Cure Greatest Hits Acoustic, both coming out in runs of 3,200 as picture discs.
Ugh. So does that mean... are those not playable, or what's the point?
I'm not sure what the point is. Anybody who's into vinyl because they like the warm sound, a picture disc sounds like crap. You know, nobody's going to play the thing. So here's an opportunity to release something that maybe the people who are dropping $150, $200 for the out-of-print version of The Cure's Greatest Hits now have an opportunity to buy it. But am I going to buy it? No, it's a picture disc. So it just seems like this whole thing is, you know, it's like misguided and it's poorly policed, and I just don't like it. It's you know, I have the list in front of me. I have 8 pages of releases here. That's not even counting international releases and, you know, the UK record store day and Japan record store day. There's 9 pages of releases, and I'm looking at a bunch of these, and I'm thinking, if these just came out. If these were just like, okay, it's Friday, it's release day, and there's going to be a new David Bowie live record from 1974 and a collection of Cheap Trick rarities and a Buddy Guy, you know, some rare, I'd buy them.
But now, let me ask you this.
I love vinyl, but to get online, to sleep overnight like many people do, to fight with people online because they got, you know, the person in front of you got the last copy of something. The whole collector's market is being created before the product is being created. I really don't like anything about it.
Well, here's the thing, you know, these days it seems like, you know, owning music is kind of an antiquated thing, that you don't own music. You just, you know, you have Spotify or Apple Music or whatever it is, and you just kind of borrow it for the month, and next month you'll borrow it all over again for $10.
This is true, and yet for me, I've always had to have the thing I loved the most. I would stream if somebody said, you know, like I'll stream the new Kendrick Lamar record because I'm curious. But I don't need to own a physical copy of the Kendrick Lamar record. Whereas I'm a Bowie freak and I want to own David Bowie vinyl in my hands because I play David Bowie a lot. And so therefore, I've always purchased the bands that I've loved and the bands that I play. The Beatles, of course. I'm not going to have a just MP3s of Sgt. Pepper on an iPod. I want the record. I want, you know. And it just seems like this could have, after 10 years of Record Store Day, it seems like they could have worked out so many of these kinks. and they haven't. It seems to get worse.
Well, now it's funny, the Beatles are celebrating Sgt. Pepper, one of their great albums, one of the great albums of all time, even not their best album, but the most one of the most important albums of all time, certainly. Big, elaborate 50th anniversary release coming up shortly this year. And what I found strange was that the stereo is the default mix that they're offering. Like if you buy the two CD set or two LP set or whatever, you get the stereo mix. But if you buy the more elaborate version, you'll also get the mono mix. And they all have like making of videos and audio and that sort of stuff and bonus outtakes.
Well, that's because it's a new stereo mix. Giles Martin went in and redid this. It's not just the basic stereo mix that we've heard for 50 years, not the stereo mix that are on the 2009 remasters. This is a brand new stereo mix.
That's lovely, but that should not be the first mix. The first mix should be the brilliant mono mix, which is how the album was originally created by Jordan. Do all the remixes you want. Mess with it all you want. Give me 27 different mixes, but the primary one should be the classic mono. I still don't understand why mono was ignored all those decades, but I mean, that sounds amazing. So I don't think a new stereo mix done not by George Martin should be the primary version of the album that they're offering. To me, that's bizarre.
I don't see it that way at all. I disagree with you. If the mono mix is the go-to mix, which many of us believe, there it is. Don't touch with it. Don't mess with it. He went in with the blessing from Paul and Ringo and all involved to go in because he had a vision for this new stereo mix, which will then add the two extra tracks, Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields, I think.
To make it the actual greatest album of all time, yeah.
Right, okay. And so that was the project. But by saying let's remix the mono mix, then that's not what the vision was in the first place. So to get the new stereo mix, that's fine. They're doing an affordable 2-record set. I think they did it perfect. I think it's perfect. You want the new stereo mix? You get that, and you get a bonus disc on vinyl of the best of the alternates and outtakes. If you're really a diehard and you want everything, you can go ahead and buy, you know, the $150 thing.
They're not presenting this as the Sgt. Pepper. They're saying this is just an alternate version. It's not the class. They're not going to make this what they put in a box set of Sgt. Pepper. This will not become the new Sgt. Pepper. Forget about the old version. This is just a different thing.
It's no different than what you hear on Let It Be Naked. It's no different than the mashups on the Beatles' Love. It's no different.
Okay, because I misunderstood, because Rolling Stone, everybody just says, oh, they're releasing Sgt. Pepper. They didn't say, oh, here's this different fun thing. They made it sound like this is going to become the de facto where you turn to when you're going to listen to Sgt. Pepper, and little kids will go, oh, yeah, that's Sgt. Pepper, but it's not.
Are you saying that the media was somewhat superficial in their coverage of something? I'm shocked.
Rolling Stone. And the press release from the record label confused me. Because I thought they're saying, here's Sgt. Pepper. And I'm like, what are you talking about? That's not Sgt. Pepper.
It's a new stereo mix, which I'm excited to hear. I think it's a good project. But you'll be
upset if they say, when you buy a Beatles box set, that should not be the de facto only version of Sgt. Pepper that they include.
Of course. But that's not what they're saying. So it's okay.
All right.
They're not saying that. But going back to Record Store Day for a second, you know, in terms of being records being done properly, you can buy, okay, let's go through the list. The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Elvis Presley. Let's start with those three since they happen to be three well-known artists. Their records, okay, the vinyl on those three giants are beautiful pieces of vinyl, replicated to look like the original versions. The sound quality is outstanding. The packaging is outstanding, and they're less than $25 if you want to buy them. And yet, some of these pieces that are coming out, I'm trying to find one in particular, but. Some of this new vinyl it comes out of the sleeve with scuffs on it. The double records are both shoved into one sleeve instead of a gatefold sleeve.
So what you're saying is the product that they're selling is of an inferior quality.
Not every
it's not
piece.
Done with care. Just not done with care necessarily.
it's just that it can be done. Now, clearly, there's probably always going to be a market for Beatles catalog. Probably. There is. Of course there is. There's always going to be a market for Beatles catalog. And just maybe Blitz and Trapper is not going to sell records 25 years from now. Just maybe. Okay. But that shouldn't be licensed to make shoddy product and pass it off as some, you know, collectible wonder. I mean, there's just, I could go on, and I'm doing it now, and I apologize, but it's such a sore spot for me. You know, I look at what's coming out. You wait 3 months, 6 months, and all those records that you saw on eBay for $149.99, and all those records that you couldn't get online because it was
not selling.
They're all going to be on eBay for list price, for even less. Because that's just the way it's going to be.
Well, and people can find your stuff on Facebook. You have a group that people can join called AMPM Records, and you've sold albums and music in every possible way, really. And this is perhaps your primary one now, along with record shows. I'm not sure what's the biggest market for you.
AMPM is it started out as this. Let's see if we can sell a record on Facebook. And we'll call the group AMPM. We'll put one up in the morning. We'll put one up in the evening, and let's see if anybody jumps on it. Well, we put a record up at 9:15, and it sold at 9:18. So now, what do you do until 6 p.m.? So it turned into two records a day, into as many as we could possibly list. It takes work. You got to photograph the records. You got to write about the records. You got to upload the records. You got to describe condition. And, you know, not everybody is, you know, if we have 800 change members in the group, not everybody is on at the same time. There are at least 700 members who haven't bought a thing in 3 years. But the people that are there and the people that really love what we do, we post records and seconds later they sell. People fight, not fight in a bad way, but they're like, man, you got to be quick on this site. We put records up and they sell immediately.
And that's a lot of trust because they know the people have bought them and they respond and they say, hey, look, it came in great condition, exactly like you promised, because you're buying it sight unseen and people want to study the vinyl. But they've learned through all the people on your site, hey, yeah, these guys are legit. They're never going to screw you over. Everything they describe is exactly how it is. And in fact, it's often better than you make it sound.
That's right. And one of the things we try to do, not always, but almost always, is we try to be less than any other available copy online. So if I've got a copy, I'm looking at something right here. If I've got a copy of Slade and their record Slade with an ED, and if I see that my copy, an equivalent copy of this, is selling for $15 plus shipping online, I will make sure that the copy I'm selling will be $15 shipped. This way, there's no question about, you know, well, can you do this for that? Can you match that price? Almost always, I'm going to be less than everybody else if I can afford to do it.
How does it compare to what you've been doing in the last, you know, it's been a struggle. You had an office space after the store closed. Then you went to selling online via eBay and other sites or Amazon. How is this working out? Is it a really vibrant, growing thing for you?
It's a lot. Again, it's a tedious process, which I don't mind because it's what I do. It's my job and it's fine. I do miss the interaction. I do miss having, you know, I could sell a record a lot more quickly if I could talk about it or put on a song for somebody as opposed to just describing it. I mean, how many times can you say amazing in a paragraph, you know?
Will you ever include links? You can include links to music tracks, you know?
We do. I'll put a video of a track or I'll, you know, I do that. It's just, there was a time when we were running out of inventory. We were selling so many records in one day that we ran out. We had no records for a record show. That's how many records we sold online on this Facebook group that we were selling out of the boxes that were prepped to bring to record shows. So you could run out of inventory that way, but it's deceiving. It's very deceiving. You sometimes get frustrated when you say, look, here's a $150 record for half price and no one's jumping on it. And sometimes people would rather buy 10 records at $5 each than one record for $50. It just feels better.
Well, but you've got it, and it's a community, and you've also got a community on Burnwood Tonight, which is your website, your blog, where you talk about music all the time. Right now, you're in the midst of this big project called The Other 100, where you say, yeah, when everybody lists their best albums of all time, you've always got the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper, Joni Mitchell, Blue, and so on, and you're saying, hey, these are the albums I would include on the other 100, the next 100, the stuff that I love and that people are passionate about. Maybe it's the second great album by an artist who's already on that list. And we've got links to that in our show notes. You've got, of course, the on Facebook, AMPM Records. You go to record stores all the time, and you've got a new album hitting stores. It's already in stores, the John Sally Ride. The album is A New Set of Downs. So I love the opening track, One of These Days. You'll have one of those days. I love the fade out from the second to last track to the last track and how it ends. It's a really good power pop album. And Sal, congrats with that. I can't wait to hear when the shows begin, the concerts begin. Make sure you post it. And thanks for joining us here.
And thank you for all of that. Thank you very much. I love talking to you guys.
Are you going on tour? Are there plans for are you going to get in one of those old vans that breaks down every 5.5 feet that you have to push to the next gas station?
I don't think there isn't a tour in all works. We'll hopefully play a couple of local gigs or maybe a little further out East Coast things. We'll see. There's nothing written in stone yet about a tour, but once the record hits properly, we will definitely do some shows. We all want to play. So if for no other reason for ourselves, but that'll happen hopefully throughout the summer.
Well, certainly we look forward to it. And I know Michael will be mentioning it when that happens.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
All right. Well, that was good to sound a drop by. It is a good album, a totally relief, but it's true. If it wasn't, I wouldn't have had him on the show. No, I just would have been like, but no, it's always good to talk to Sal. He's passionate about music. He's made a living out of it in 18. And he also plays in soul bands and cover bands and bands that, he's just always is performing, has been for many years. This new project is really cool. I've never seen him when he's had a new album of new material. And that happening, being picked up by a label, is cool. So it's really fun to see.
I've always been, just coming back from New York, one of the things I notice is that on every street corner, there's somebody performing music with some instrument of some kind, and they are in bars and restaurants, they're in parks, I've never seen, I guess also, I don't walk around that much in Los Angeles.
So one does.
Yeah, so maybe the same thing is happening in LA, but certainly nobody notices it.
Well, there's certainly a music scene in LA. Most good cities have it, Nashville, Chicago, Minneapolis. There's lots of good music everywhere. But yeah, there's a lot of buskers in New York. It's partially a sign of, people here for their dreams, and partly a sign of hard times.
Well, nobody comes to LA for their dreams anymore, not after La La Land.
Well, David Letterman never did he? He stayed in New York and followed his dreams right there.
That almost sounds like a book I should be reading. I read about it somewhere. Maybe it was the New York Times book review. Maybe it was Book Filter, in fact. In fact, it is time for our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And every week, Michael, you give us a few books that either we, the listeners, should be reading or the industry itself should be paying attention to for possible adaptations. So, Michael, what is it this week? What should Hollywood be reading?
Well, this isn't a pitch so much, but this week, one of the books I read that I finished that came out this week is The Road to Jonestown by Jeff Gwynn, which is a story of Jim Jones, the cult leader, and the People's Temple and the Jonestown mass suicide in Guyana. I've always been kind of fascinated by cults, done a lot of research on them and as a fact checker over the years, and didn't know much about Jonestown. And it was an interesting, good read, and weird stuff going on there than you would think. Weird in the sense that, he actually was doing some good stuff early on. So it's a little more complicated. You think, how can someone join a cult? How can they not? It happens slowly. And sometimes they're doing good stuff for quite a while. So maybe it doesn't seem so crazy at the time.
And I assume that we should maybe not make the Kool-Aid recipe at the end of the book.
It's Flavor-Aid, actually, not Kool-Aid.
Okay.
But somehow Kool-Aid was easier to remember. But they used a cheaper alternative called Flavor-Aid. but that's right. And the families involved in that, thank you for making fun of their tragedy. But, you know, Jones had cult followers, and David Letterman, I don't know if you can be considered a cult following when you're that famous and popular now, but certainly at the beginning, he had cult followers watching his morning show on NBC. I was one of them on dominated television for decades. And now there's a biography called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night, by Jason Zinnemann, a reporter for the New York Times. He covers comedy. He covers television a bit. Absolutely justified to call Letterman the last giant of late night. They're all midgets. No, that's derogatory to midgets. They're all minor talents compared to Letterman. It feels like will be seen again because it's a changing landscape. But I imagine a lot of people in Hollywood will be diving into this book because they want to find out about his tortured life, how he feels, all the backstage drama, who he really is. So I think it is the sort of book that a lot of people in Hollywood will be cracking. I don't think there's dirty revelations or anything like that, but I think he is a fascinating figure that people don't know a lot about, and I'm looking forward to reading it.
Will it explain why, since leaving television, David Letterman has grown a giant beard and looks like a hermit?
There is no good explanation for that. It is crazy. My God. But yes, it bothers me too.
Well, I wish somebody would explain that to me.
Yes, and if they did, it would be a big deal, blah, blah, blah.
Okay, it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop. We've given up, apparently, on segueing into this.
I could see you setting it up. I'm like, yeah, let's move on.
Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, actor Asia Kate Dillon is tearing it up on the new season of the TV drama Billions. To cast the role of financial wonderkin Taylor Mason, the show chose to audition cis, trans, and gender non-binary actors. Now that Emmy buzz is happening, they ask Dillon, who identifies as gender non-binary, what category to be submitted under. After consideration, Dillon chose supporting actor, but reached out to the Academy about their rules on the matter. They replied promptly that anyone could submit under whichever category they choose. So a good conversation by all, but is the day looming when categories like actor and actress will seem dated? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. That's sort of interesting. I liked how Asia Kate Dillon handled it. I liked how the Academy responded. But I was having the same thought because the Jimmy Awards are coming up. This is a thing in New York City where kids from high schools all over the country come to the city for a week and they practice and perform a whole new show and they do it on a Broadway stage. It's very, very cool. And they end up at the end with like one male winner and one female winner. And I thought, you know what? I'm knowing these kids or parents of kids in high school and grade school who have other kids who are saying, I don't identify as male or female, or I'm trans. And I thought, you know what? This is going to get a little outdated pretty soon, sooner than you think. You're going to have kids coming up going, well, I don't identify as a male or female. And so what happens then? Do you have three winners? Do you, you know, how are they going to deal with this? I don't know. It's complicated. I know they're going to want to do it in a respectful, positive way. But I do think it's an interesting thought. And again, you could easily say, well, what, however the character identifies is the way you want to, submit them or choose to honor certain performances. But then what if the character doesn't identify as male or female?
Yeah, I mean, look, I was at Columbia University last week and on the bathrooms there, and some of them in Lowe Library, the kind of well-known picturesque library there on campus, the bathrooms had signs that said, please use the restroom to which you most identify. Yeah,
knock yourself out. Go wherever you want.
Pretty much. The trees, please. Although I will say that, and this is not to make light of this, non-binary is a new term for me, at least. To me, binary means, 1-0, your computer coding. You know, it's
right. And they're saying they're not 1-0. They're not male or female, nor did they identify. And, they're saying, it's like the intersex. It's the Jeffrey Eugenides novel, Middlesex, about a person who's, sexual organs do not conform to strictly male or female, and identified as intersex and not thinking that needs to be fixed or that there's something wrong with that. Let the person deal with that when they're adult, if they choose to. It's a whole great, big, beautiful world out there, isn't it?
Well, except for some people like Bill O'Reilly, who is on vacation, but advertisers continue to pull their ads, even from reruns of his top rated show. Glenn Beck was booted from Fox News when advertisers fled his show, but Beck's ratings were also falling. O'Reilly returns on April 24th and is the linchpin of Fox News's entire primetime lineup. Oh, by the way, his show alone booked $450 million in ads during the last 3 years. Still, there is an internal investigation to see if the numerous complaints about O'Reilly that Fox News already knew about may suddenly lead to his dismissal. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a very different situation, but it feels like the screw up from Comedy Central, where they let all these stars fall out of their hands when they should have been able to lock them in and say, hey, we believe in you. You're the future of our programming. They messed up. This is Fox News losing Megyn Kelly, who now it's clear. Some people said that one key reason she left was because she was angry and upset about how they were handling Bill O'Reilly and the accusations against him and how he reacted to it and to things that Megyn Kelly had said and done. And they lost her and she's gone to NBC. We don't know how that'll turn out. But my God, if they lose her and O'Reilly or choose to lose O'Reilly, that's going to have a big impact on Fox News. Tucker Carlson's doing fine right now. You know, he's replaced Megyn Kelly, but without O'Reilly as a lead-in, I don't know how well that's going to hold up.
Sometimes the muggles get it right. That's certainly the case for Harry Potter fans. They're delighted that the epic two-part stage adaptation won more Olivier Awards in London than any other show in history. 9 in all, beating out recent record holders like Matilda and the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. Now, the show's arrival in New York in 2018 is anticipated even more feverishly. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
What?
Because it couldn't be more anticipated anyway. It didn't matter what the critics thought to a degree. That may mean the difference between a 2 or 3 year run and a 5 or 8 year run. So it matters eventually. But frankly, it just could not be bigger already. It's kind of amazing. You think of the novels and then the films. And now the spinoff films are working well. The theme park attractions. And now stage adaptations. You know, Harry Potter is going to last for a long, long time.
If you want to know where people are spending their leisure time, follow the money. In Asian markets, you'll
Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, apparently.
Sorry.
That's a political joke for those of you not following American news. In Asian markets, you'll be following the money online. That's where all the ad spending is happening. The 14 Asia-Pacific markets hit $170 billion in ad revenue last year, and the biggest medium wasn't TV or radio. It was online. The internet became the biggest money earner in 5 key markets, including China, Australia, Korea, New Zealand, and Taiwan. In another 5 years, you can probably add Japan, Singapore, and Hong Kong to that list. Although, isn't Hong Kong part of China? I mean, so...
Not as a market?
Okay. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Seems like a very big deal. I mean, it is a turning point that we've seen coming for a while, but now it's happened. And it just seems like, you know, yeah, wow, the wave of the future. When will this happen in North America? I guess we know it will. We expect it to. I don't know.
Well, I think it's happening in North America and has been for some time in kind of internet first markets, if you will, or, you know, where the internet caught on first. However, if you really look at who is getting most of that money, I think you'll find, like in life, there are a, you know, there's a cream at the very top that's getting most of that money.
And that would be content that is valuable, that's being created by the same people who appear on the networks.
Or they have created a brand online like a YouTube where people are going there and have been going there for the last 10, 12 years. And so they're already receiving a great deal of traffic.
So the internet is not some magical new world where everybody makes money. There's big winners and lots of smaller fry trying to make a living, just like there is everywhere else.
Yes. We will be putting a donate button on our website.
We need to. Okay.
Skinny bundles are here for good. People can access packages of TV shows, including the major networks, local channels, and key cable outlets, all with just an internet connection. Will that drive down prices for pay cable or just drive up prices for internet connections? Can I answer that question? I think it's going to be the latter. Well, YouTube, they don't really care about any of that. They've launched YouTube TV in 5 major cities for just $35 a month. People in New York City, LA, Chicago, Philly, and San Francisco can decide for themselves what the best deal might be. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I guess this particular moment is a big whoop. It's just a launch, partial launch of YouTube TV. But yeah, you know, this is it. It's done. It's happened. It's here. Now we're going to see the fallout. And it's not about people cutting the cord and never wanting to watch TV again. It's about paying for it in a different way and having more competition. I do think it's possible, well, I think it's inevitable that the all these packages will force some price lowering among the big fat cable company packages. We know when you're buying Time Warner Cable, and yeah, they got 500 channels, and I like all that, but I do think there's going to be some pressure to lower the cost of that.
Well, certainly, what will happen is the cable companies will receive pressure from their customers. Certainly, the cable companies will then pressure the networks, saying, hey, we're not going to pay $1 per month per subscriber for that network. We'll pay 50 cents. And that will lower the bill.
All right.
Now, we kind of touched on this next story while talking with Sal. The music streaming service Spotify wants to go public. You know, the big IPO where everybody gets rich. Everybody but you and I, Michael. I don't know how we'll get rich off of that. But Spotify, it needs to secure deals with the big record labels before that can happen. They're one step closer thanks to reaching an agreement with Universal Music Group, one of the big three record companies. For the first time, artists can keep their new albums off of the free tier of Spotify for 2 weeks after an album has been released. Singles will still be available to all listeners, but only users paying for the premium service will be able to listen to an album for those first 2 weeks. After that, it will be available to all. Spotify has some 50 million free users and another 50 million paid subscribers around the world. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it feels like, I'm just not clear about some of the details. Like, was there a change in the gross income? Because that was the big sticking point. And I couldn't find any info on that. But it seems like they needed to lower the amount of money they hand over to the record labels. And of course, the labels and the artists want more. If they were able to do that and set a standard that others might follow, then it's a big deal. If they didn't, then it's a really big whoop and a danger sign for them.
You know, here's the thing. The reason that you're not seeing a lot of the financial details on this is probably because Spotify and the record labels don't want you to see that. And instead, they're saying, well, here's a few details that might kind of hold you over and maybe stop making you ask questions about what the deal is.
Well, but that's, people, they have to know. I mean, there's no interest until they know exactly what the deal was, that seems a little silly. But music is still where it's at. People can still make attention. Mariah Carey signed a new record deal with Epic. Talk about doing it old school. She's with the Epic record label, and she's going to put out a new album, and she's going to try and, revitalize her career, which has been probably on a serious downslide since a decade ago with the Emancipation of Mimi. That was her last big album. She's down to selling like a couple 100,000 copies of her last two or three. Hasn't had a top 10 single since, 2009. So, it's been a long time since she's been on top, but she's still a worldwide brand, and, maybe they'll be able to do the magic.
Well, now that we know she just lip syncs everything, it doesn't really matter, right?
That's not true.
I know, I'm just kidding. Twitter has been blindsided by Amazon, of all people. The online retailer came from out of nowhere to pummel the 140-character app into the dirt. Twitter fumbled the ball, Amazon scooped it up, and the 10-game package of NFL's Thursday Night Football games belongs to Amazon for a mere $50 million. That ends our sports metaphor of the day. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. One odd online partner switched for another. But, I have to tell you, as many people have said, Thursday Night Football is just a travesty. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's bad for the game. It's bad for the players. Everybody hates it. It's just a power money grab. It's bad for the game long term, just not even the quality of the game. It's bad for them as a market, as the NFL to sell the football, to have it on so many nights of the week. It's just a disaster. And the fact that it's continuing is a really good sign that the NFL is not getting its act together yet.
Well, we talked about YouTube and we're talking about Amazon and all this streaming. But, every couple of years, Michael, I take a year off from Coachella, right? Just, to give the grass, a way to grow. It's also, I'm getting older and walking around the desert is for three straight days in the heat, can be a little trying. And this year, like in years past that I skipped, I watched on YouTube. So I was able to gauge how that experience has transcended or kind of changed over time. And I have to say, I've got the big TV now, Michael. I told you how I bought that 60-inch television. And I thought, well, let's see if I can actually stream Coachella, not on my laptop, not on my desktop, not on my tablet or my phone. Well, let's see if I can get it all the way to the big television and how that looks. And I have to report that it was, at times, absolutely stunning. I couldn't believe the quality of you know, how good
the sound and the image were. Yes. They cutting a lot? Was it a slightly sane presentation?
It was a very sane presentation because they don't have a lot of cameras. Okay.
Oh, good.
So, you know, there's really, except for the main stage and the outdoor theater, there might be, you know, six cameras at each one of those. And, you know, they don't really have a lot of choices, so to speak. And certainly in the Sahara tent, you know, a lot of those tents with the electronic music and some of the other acts, they have maybe three cameras or two cameras. So they're really challenged. That said, you know, part of the problem with broadcasting it, whether it be on cable or streaming online, is the lighting is not conducive to, you know, television. Frankly, it's just very difficult to shoot that stuff where you have bright lights all of a sudden glaring into the lens of the camera. But I have to say, it was really very good. And I watched Hans Zimmer. I didn't think, here's a guy, he's a music composer, right? I mean, What the heck is he doing at a rock and pop music festival? Yet, amazing set. He was one of the best things I saw.
Well, cool. And do you feel like you're going to go back to Coachella? You're like, I don't know. This is kind of almost as good.
You know, it's funny you said that. I was sitting there last night watching Lord thinking, why the heck would I go to this show now when I could stay at home and get a much better view of what I would effectively be seeing, you know, because I'm not the tallest guy in the room. Yeah. And so, you know, technically I'm constantly looking at the screens anyway. And I do get that when you're there and you're caught up with 100,000 people watching the show, it's a completely different feel and a completely different vibe. There's no doubt about it. So eventually I will go back, but I can definitely say that it's a really good experience watching online. Cool. Especially if you can get it to your big screen TV or even a, you know, modest size television. But of course, if you were streaming it, say, on Periscope or any one of those, you know, I don't think Periscope exists. I don't know, all those, like, you know, Vines and all those, like, live Facebook Live things. I know Facebook Live is still around. You could be sued, actually. And when you're big, you get sued. Still, it's got to sting a little when Disney gets sued over the film Zootopia, and part of the complaint filed against them discusses what the lawyers claim is Disney's long-standing practice of ripping off ideas. Believe it or not, their first witness will be Sleeping Beauty. So, screenwriter Gary Goldman, best known for Total Recall and being producer on Minority Report, offers up info on an exceptionally detailed pitch that included a live-action movie, a combo movie, and then an animated movie, all part of an elaborate universe of films, including sketches of characters and the like. At the same time, a lawsuit against Disney over profits from the sitcom Home Improvement is going forward after a rather damaging ruling by a judge that said the plaintiffs might well succeed in their case. Disney wanted to dismiss it for not being filed in time, of course, but given Hollywood's notorious practice of dragging out audits over years and years and millennia, the judge said, yeah, no dice. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, it'll be a big deal if they go to trial and we get to see some info about the inner workings of Hollywood.
Or never going to happen.
Never going to happen. Well, it happens sometimes. But yeah, you've got the Zootopia thing. Do people say Disney rips off ideas? Is that a known complaint against Disney? Or is that just a lawyer blowing smoke?
Well, I think you might want to ask my good friend Hans Christian Andersen, who has a few fairy tales.
That's 2-for-1 there. That's a 2-for-1 there. Home Improvement goes forward. And, you know, our legal corner. The Duck Dynasty producers were being sued and are suing. They're in a battle with the British company ITV. Well, it turns out the Dynasty guys won a key round, showing the law to be on their side quite a bit there. So that's a big step forward for them. Again, that'll probably get settled before they end up. And Stallone is suing Warner Brothers, saying that they messed up the accounting on Demolition Man. And he's shocked to find that they say the movie is not profitable when it is. So all those cases are going to be big deals if they actually go to trial and we learn some stuff. If not, it'll be behind closed doors and it'll just be a big whoop.
And I have a feeling we all know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
Now, a new survey claims that 84% of all TV watching, like my watching Coachella in the U.S., that is done live. Okay, I was watching it live even though it was being streamed. Comscore's annual survey dubbed Cross-Platform Future in Focus. That's the name of the report, okay? Cross-Platform Future in Focus. Well, that report says only 15% of viewing takes place on DVRs. Only 1% is on demand. The numbers bump up for prime time only, with 75% watching done live and 25% of all primetime TV shows watched via DVR. Only 15% of households are OTT only, or over the top. But of course, for pay TV companies, that's 15% too much. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a lot of numbers. Basically, people still watch a lot of TV live. But then again, you say, wait a second, primetime shows, major networks, one out of four shows are watched on DVR. That's pretty big. That's a massive sea change. I don't watch anything live, practically. So I'm still going, people not know how to use your DVRs. Why are you watching things live? But I guess things are on in diners and bars and restaurants. People at home during the day have the TV on. I guess that's what's going on here. It's just on in the background a little bit. But focused watching primetime, it is now up to one out of four. I would have thought it'd be higher by now. I don't watch any primetime shows with commercials and waiting for the thing to come back on. I guess still people like having trips to the bathroom.
The next Star Wars movie doesn't appear until December, but they just debuted a trailer online that naturally scored millions of views faster than a wombat and a... faster than a parsec and a... you know what? I can't remember. Yeah, never mind. The point is, a lot of people watched it and parsed every single frame by frame, and then wrote about it on blogs. Of course, the film marks the final filmed appearance of the late actress Carrie Fisher, and the studio praised her work and took this very early opportunity to make clear once again they wouldn't be using any digital trickery to insert Carrie Fisher into Star Wars 9 in 2019. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop because it's going to happen someday, and it will happen, and it will at some point become artistically interesting, and we'll just have to wait for that day to come.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what they're also saying is, look, there's no footage of Carrie Fisher that we're going to use in the next episode. So nothing was shot where she's in it, or maybe there is something that's shot, but we're not going to
use it. We're talking about the one in 2019.
Yes, correct. The current one, of course, has already been shot and edited and is currently going through post-production.
And I have to tell you, I watched the trailer, and my God, you know, if the Star Wars movies were as good as their trailers, starting with Phantom Menace, they would just be like the greatest series of all time.
I mean, they really do
great trailers.
They absolutely do great trailers, and then they actually throw in all this other stuff that makes the trailers bad.
Yeah.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I'll tell you how this story might affect you if it actually comes to pass. You're not going to be able to watch a lot of shows, a lot of late night shows, because there's no writers. Nobody will be able to write anything. Everybody will just be winging it, kind of like I do all the time.
That's right. So yeah, the writer's strike is looming. Maybe a strike on May 2nd, which is my birthday. Talks have resumed, but everyone seems to be miles apart. And ratcheting up the tension, the WGA has been reaching out to advertisers and others saying, hey, this is happening. Just warning you, if we don't make a deal, not going to be any TV going on.
Yeah, I mean, the writers have slid the piece of paper across the desk there. They're at the negotiating table, and the studios have unfolded it, and it looks like the writers are asking for, the world. The world. Yeah, they're not going to get it. But
they're asking for the world, or the studios just no interest in, they don't want to give them anything?
I just thought
they're saying, hey, you're making your money on streaming. We need more money from streaming.
Yeah, no, look, I think the writers have a point here. I was joking around, of course, but I do think that we talked about what they were asking for in the last episode. They're looking for some kind of relief on holds. You know, because all these writers are being held.
Yeah, because that's a big problem, yeah.
Pension and health and welfare they're looking for, and they want parity with so that cable networks pay the same rate as broadcast networks. Right now, cable networks like AMC, with the most popular shows on television, pays writers two-thirds of what they would get if those same shows were on NBC, CBS, Fox, etc.
Well, that's not asking the moon, is it?
No. I mean, they can probably come to terms with... maybe the parity, maybe the holds. I don't know about pension and welfare.
Well, the holds are tricky, but they just got to be more flexible. They can't keep people on hold for a year and a half when they've done six episodes.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, I mean, that's why I think they
can. It's ridiculous.
Find,
it's like, yeah, I know, but you got to work it out, because you can't say, sorry, you can't work for a year because you wrote on six episodes. You know, it's not like a 22 episode deal, and then you find out within 6 months whether it's going forward. It's a whole new world, but you cannot use the same old restrictions on the writers. It's just not fair. They got to make a living.
Well, from scripted content to content that is not scripted at all because it's taking place live and we never know the end result because it's sports. We never know how it's going to end. It's like a surprise ending every time, sort of. We're talking about ESPN. Okay, this is
Well, that's right. And they actually will be affected by the writer's strike because there is a lot of writing that goes on there. You've got your ESPN Sports Center. You've got people with introductions and outros and set pieces going on for, you know, football games and all that sort of stuff. So there is writing. It will impact them. But presumably, they could weather the writer's strike better than most.
Yes, proving me wrong once again.
Reality TV, there are writers there as well. Don't think that that's, reality TV has a lot of writers a lot of times.
Don't call them writers, call them producers because that's what the networks want you to call them.
Otherwise, they have to get paid more.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're talking about ESPN because Bloomberg.com had a really good, significant meaty feature about ESPN and the future. It says ESPN has seen the future of TV and they're not really into it.
No. As a matter of fact, they're not a part of it, actually, when you look at it.
There's still a huge ratings draw. So what's going on with ESPN? What are their numbers? What's the status? You know, we're looking at their baseball card. Where are they at?
Well, they've peaked at 100 million subscribers in 2011. They lost 12 million subscribers since then, thanks to cord cutting and rising costs. And they've dumped
a lot of stuff.
They've dumped on-air talent.
Now they're trying to lower costs and they can't stop paying for football, baseball, basketball and the like. So they're dumping a lot of on-air talent. They're trying to keep staying where they are, and you know, they want to they get the most money of any channel, right? Of any cable channel
by far.
Per subscriber.
They've been getting
$7 per subscriber and they want to keep getting that. But when they did this is one of the big issues that Bloomberg points out. At one point, they said, we have to get our $7. We do not want to lower our subscriber rate. If we do, we'll be doomed. And people said, fine. But they got them to agree that in exchange, they wouldn't be included in every single bundle.
Yes. Now, they said, I should mention, you say, you know, they are the most expensive channel on basic cable.
Right. Basic cable. Not talking about HBO or things like
exactly.
that.
Premium cable, you know, obviously is more.
Right. So pointing this out as a strategic error is the idea that they wanted to maintain their number so much that they caved in on another element, which is that they wouldn't always be included in every bundle. They imagined perhaps everybody wants ESPN, and it's just not true. And therefore, that's one reason you've seen their numbers fall by 12 million subscribers in the last 6 years.
Well, they're also a lot of people. It's kind of the, when it used to be that you'd kind of like rent your phone from the phone company.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you didn't have to rent it anymore. You could buy it. You didn't have to pay for it. But how long did it take for people to figure out, oh, I could just buy my phone?
A while.
It took years. So a lot of people will just, you know, they'll subscribe to cable and it will come in the basic bundle. And they won't know that they could turn around to the cable company and say, hey, that really expensive $7 channel, I don't want that. They won't know that they can say that. Eventually, they'll figure it out.
So this article says, hey, you know, you can see streaming is coming, over the top is coming, apps like HBO on the go or whatever their standalone app is called
HBO
that you can
now.
Purchase.
HBO Now.
Thank you. ESPN's like, I don't know. So they do have, of course, a lot of good numbers. They had $11 billion in gross revenue last year. They're hugely profitable. They're just not as profitable as they used to be. The skinny bundles that we're talking about, they almost all include, or perhaps all do include, ESPN right now. And they still get $7 per subscriber. They did get 1 million new over-the-top subscribers, presumably through some of these skinny bundles. And that's not reflected in the totals yet. So they're hoping that, yeah, as people migrate to skinny bundles, they'll still want ESPN as part of their package, that that'll be seen as a must-have, at least by the people creating the skinny bundles, and that will keep them, you know, in the mix. We're not rushing to change what we do because it's so profitable.
Well, to put that in perspective, ESPN is earning $11 billion per year, or they are earning one North American box office per year.
One
channel. When you really put it in perspective,
that's gross revenue.
Well, yeah, of course, yes.
Yeah, because they pay a lot for rights fees.
Correct.
And they're not dead yet, is their message to us.
Oh, I see what you're trying to do. I can't do a transition, but somehow you can do a transition. In fact, let's do a transition into talking about the Trans-Siberian Orchestra founder, Paul O'Neill, who, look at that. I didn't even know I was doing that when I did it. Unfortunately, Paul O'Neill, the founder of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, passed away last week.
Yeah, it's one of these crazy groups. He just was a behind-the-scenes player in music industry, and then someone said, hey, you should do your own band. And he said, I love big metal. I love big pop. I love big flashy bands like Queen. I'm going to put it all together and record Christmas music. And it's just became a monster. He's sold 10 million albums over the last two decades, which, you know, isn't a ton, but it's a lot. But he's really a touring monster. This is just one of the most elaborate touring acts you've ever seen in your life. Light shows, fireworks, smoke, lasers, you name it. They've been a top 10 draw year after year after year. And they did a lot of their touring leading up to Christmas and New Year. Then they started to expand into Easter. It's just a phenomenon of live touring that has been all over the world and done a really big business. So the death of Paul O'Neill means a lot to the touring industry. I expect or hope or think or imagine that maybe the Trans-Siberian Orchestra will outlive him. He's built up a big name brand franchise. Maybe they can keep going on, following and building on what he created. But that's a big blow to the touring industry.
Well, maybe after his, what I think was an incredibly successful gig at Coachella, maybe Hans Zimmer can step in there. I mean, he brought an entire orchestra up on stage.
That's very cool. It's also very expensive.
I thought the same thing. As I was watching it, I thought, you could never tour because, you know, think about all the hotel rooms and all the logistics alone. Your booking fee would be millions of dollars for every gig.
Yeah, Trans-Siberian Orchestra is a very big production with a lot of people, and it's very expensive to mount, I am sure. That holiday gig vibe that they did, they were doing holiday music and touring the country and becoming sort of just an annual tradition for people out in the heartland is how they made that work. People say every year, go see Trans-Siberian Orchestra. It's the holidays. That's what you do. So it's tricky. It's not easy, but they cracked that nut.
Now, speaking of cracking nuts, I don't know where I'm going with that transition. That was a really bad transition, but I did want to mention that Michael Bauhaus died at the age of 81 last week. And if you don't know who Michael Bauhaus is, you have probably seen his work without doubt. He is a cinematographer, one of the best cinematographers that ever worked in motion pictures. He shot Goodfellas, Fabulous Baker Boys, Broadcast News, 17 films with Fassbinder, and developed a 360-degree tracking shot circling an actor. I mean, this is a guy whose work is unbelievable. He was one of my favorite cinematographers, and I was really disappointed to hear that he had passed away.
Yeah, I mean, Goodfellas has, you know, one of the most famous tracking shots of all time, that long thing underground to come up into the nightclub. Everybody knows it. It's been parodied 1,000 times. And one other person died this week, and that's Dave's mom. We mentioned David Letterman in the book filter segment. His mother, who became a fixture on his show, was a really fun presence on the show, humanized Dave in a great way. She passed away, lived a great full life, saw her son triumph as much as possible, and then the big beard. But, our sympathies go out to him and his family.
Yeah, I was wondering if we should mention that during the book filter segment, but, this seems like just the perfect spot to do so, just like it's the perfect spot to tell you something else. That you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, anywhere they aggregate podcasts, you can subscribe to our show, rate and review Showbiz Sandbox in those aggregators. It does help us out when you do that. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us, all the work of Sal Nunziata. We will place a link to it in our show notes, ways to follow us. You can follow us at Showbiz Sandbox on Twitter or like us on Facebook, where just search for Showbiz Sandbox. Our page should come up and you can like us there. You can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, I'd like to thank Sal Nunziata for joining us. His work, links to it will be on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's asbestosremovalrus.com, because that's a site you're going to have to look up.
As a matter of fact, I'm typing it now just to see if I might be able to use their services. In the meantime, I might actually jump on over to the Huffington Post to read some of your entertainment coverage, or visit michaelgiltz.com, where all of your work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.